Welcome to the Undisclosed Addendum. This is Colin Miller, one of the hosts of the Undisclosed podcast, and today I'll be discussing episode 7 of The State vs. Patricia Rohr, Dirty Blonde. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Rabia Chaudhry. Rabia, how's it going?
I'm good. Colin, how are you?
Good. Did you have a good 4th of July weekend?
I did. We had a great party. A friend of mine hosts this big annual shindig. I always say that everybody should have that one rich friend that can do things that you can't. And it was lovely. How was yours?
Yeah, it was great. I visited with some family up in New York, and, you know, other than the weather and some travel complications, it went well.
Good, good, good.
As always this season, we're also joined by Jennifer Leahy, a research and investigative assistant. She's been working with Rabia on various cases going back to the Jason Carroll case and has been a primary investigator in the Patricia Rohr case. And so, Jennifer, how's it going?
I'm doing well, Colin. How about you? I'm
doing great. How was your holiday weekend?
It was really good. It was really good. Thanks.
All right. And so this episode, as noted, we'll be discussing episode 7 of the Patricia Rohr series, and that is the Dirty Blonde episode. Before that, though, I wanted to mention a case in the news, and this is a case that has so many hallmarks of wrongful convictions and so many subjects we've covered on Undisclosed. This is the case of Daniel Vallejos in El Paso, Texas. El Paso just agreed to pay him $8 million in connection with his wrongful conviction case. He was convicted of the 1993 murders of Armando Mondo Lazo and Robert Bobby England. He was in prison for 18 years before his conviction was thrown out. And so, Rabia, going through the allegations in his lawsuit that was just settled again for $8 million, he claimed the police forced him to give a false confession. The city and police department were encouraging officers to clear cases at all costs, tolerating dishonesty while deliberately failing to supervise officers. Evidence showed that defendants' policymakers were aware the officers were fabricating evidence, lying about and covering up abuse, engaging in other forms of dishonesty. There was proof that police supervisors did not regularly review detectives' reports in high-stakes investigations. Evidence also showed that there was a policy requiring the officers to record all confessions as well as juvenile witness statements. Yet in this case and other cases, they continuously did not abide by the requirement of recording these interviews with juveniles and confessions. And so, Robbie, I mean, this feels like a lot of cases. We've covered a lot of wrongful conviction cases. So $8 million to Mr. Vallejos for 18 years of wrongful conviction.
Yeah, it's definitely not enough money. At a minimum, he should get $18 million dollars for $1 million for each year he served. But, you know, what's interesting is, was he a juvenile at the time that he was arrested?
I'm not sure if he was a juvenile, but he was certainly youngish.
It looks like, I just Googled it because I hadn't heard it. And it says he was 16 when he was arrested.
16, yeah. Okay, yeah, so he was.
Yeah, so I mean, this is the thing. Like, people ask us, how do we know that something is a wrongful conviction? I am telling you, you see the same things over and over again. Like, it's such a consistent pattern. There's also like kind of this era in which so much of this happened, right? I don't know a lot about, this is the first actually I'm hearing of the case, but I'm assuming that there was forensics that never kind of like, you know, that either contradicted, you know, this prosecution or just never got tested, that there was crappy eyewitness testimony. But yeah, the false confession in and of itself, I bet you that confession had all the hallmarks of a false confession, which is that he got details wrong, that it changed over time. I mean, we see this so many times. But you know, I'm yay that he's out. 18 years, that's a lifetime. And $8 million doesn't feel like enough, especially because the state's going to take a good chunk of that. But yeah, what are your thoughts on this, Colin?
$8 million, not enough. Exact same page as you. And yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, this is what I teach my wrongful conviction students. And this is what we're starting to see in these reform bills. we need to record all of these custodial interrogations. And if the officers fail to comply with that,
throw it out.
And because we see all these cases, and we've had people on the podcast before in connection with the Willie Vesey series, and they tell you, this was in Philadelphia specifically, there are records of police interrogations and confessions before recording and after.
Yeah.
And everything looks fundamentally different once they're recorded, because everything was made up before that device was on.
Yeah. I mean, look, we're going to get into this episode 8, next week's episode, about how even a police report, right? Like, you, just because a policeman wrote, you know, an officer wrote something down as their recorded statement of some interaction or a conversation with a potential witness, doesn't mean it's accurate at all. You know, and so it comes down to the same thing. I mean, I feel like I feel like every interaction with the police should be recorded at this point. I don't trust police statements. I don't trust anything. We have seen over and over again, you go back to witness and they're like, that's not what I said, actually. And so, yeah, it's slow. It's a slow process to reform all these little pieces, but these seem like very fundamental type of, fixes, right? Yeah. That could save a lot of heartache.
And Robbie, that's a pivot point to the episode, what you just mentioned about the trust that some people place in police reports, because episode 7, Dirty Blonde, this is all about how the police get Patty Roar in their crosshairs. And Robbie, a part of that is this ex-boyfriend, Conrad Hewitt, and the police speak to Hewitt's sister, and she divulges information, which, as we noted in the episode, was not favorable to Patty. But Rabia, why, when we look at this police report and Hewitt's sister, would we have reason to question the veracity of this?
I mean, there's bad blood, first of all. Mm-hmm. I mean, like, we're not talking about people who are unbiased. There's a lot of bad blood. And yeah, the police are right now, what they're doing is, in a way, they're kind of justifying their target. They're collecting all the bad information they can about Patty. They're talking to the people who hate Patty, who she's had a bad relationship with. I mean, this guy Blalock, her ex, another officer says, like, he's like the worst guy in the entire county, the worst criminal you can come across. Like, he'll do anything short of murder. Like, and you're asking him his opinion about, you know, Patty, when the record reflects that Patty, in fact, like, you know, these charges of, like, you know, like when she was charged along with Blalock for stealing horses, they realized, oh, she actually had nothing to do with it. They dropped the charges against her. A lot of it's just like, you know, and it's interpersonal stuff. I'm not saying that Patty was a perfect person and she never got in a fight. She did. She knows she did. She had issues. Right. I mean, like, and this was kind of like the environment. I mean, when you look at all these people, I'm sure if we asked others about, Blalock or Conrad Hewitt or his Hewitt's sister or any of these people, others would probably have negative things to say about them as well. And Hewitt is the guy who, you know, beat her up so badly. Right. You know, she was so badly abused by him. And so going to him for information about her, I mean, it's, yeah.
Right. And Jen, yeah, and what's your take to Rabia's point that she just made? This is an ex-boyfriend who beat Patty up badly, and yet it seems from the files that they're relying on the sister's statement about her being moody and, you know, acting up a bit. I mean, this is a horribly abusive relationship, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think when I was reading through it and then reflecting on it now, it's been a bit since I first read through those reports. I remember reading some of these things and being like, you know, like, they're not favorable, right? They are like subjective, but you're like, okay. But then, like, reflecting on it and then reading more, and then, you know, without giving anything away, you read, you know, there are witnesses and friends that come forward with an entirely different story. So, like, the importance of collecting these different viewpoints, you know, like, there's
that, and at the end of the day, none of it's evidence, right? I mean, like, you know, right, yeah.
Yeah, and Rabia, you mentioned, as we were discussing Conrad Hewitt, we also have, of course, Walter Blalock, and this is at the heart of the investigation into Patty. And we closed episode 6 and then followed up in episode 7 with this FBI murder for hire memo. And in that memo, it says they have information that Patty visited Pennsylvania in 1994. And there's this whole dispute about whether Patty acknowledged this or claimed she hadn't been there since 1991. But the question that we have remaining is, at the time of this memo, we don't have anything in the file that would indicate the police had received, or the FBI had received information that Patty was in Pennsylvania in 1994. Is that, that's right, right? We don't know where this information comes from.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming it comes, look, what this, that points out to me, and I think we've seen this repeatedly, is that there are conversations and interactions happening with the police and Patty and other witnesses that are just not part of the record. You know, I mean, like even the issue of Patty being asked numerous times to take a polygraph, when, in which police report is that recorded? Like, you know, so there are things, and, you know, we'll talk about another witness in next week's episode who we only have like one or two on the record conversations of reports of interviews the police did with him. But apparently, according to him, they just kept coming and coming and coming. It's kind of like that Jay Wilde situation where you don't have the evidence that they keep like harassing these witnesses, but they were. I don't know where they got that information. But on that issue of Patty being in Pennsylvania, according to Patty, because I'll just go ahead and address it now. According to Patty, when, and again, this is why like we can't rely on these police statements, because they'll just write down what they, either what that officer remembers, sometimes it's a day later, sometimes it's even weeks later, or they write down what they want to write down. And I haven't seen, and Jen, correct me if I'm wrong, in any of the, we have three statements from Patty, three official statements in the record, December, April, and May. I don't remember seeing in any one of those statements whether the question was asked, were you there or not? I don't remember. But here's what Patty says. So Patty says that she remembers like them being asked that. And she, when she responded, what she meant was that she'd been to Pennsylvania for these horse auctions, but she had not been to Catasauqua or Bethlehem or that particular, like the Lehigh Valley is what she said. She's like, I did go, I mean, like, you know, right, to sell horses and to do these horse events, but I wasn't in that area.
And the non-nefarious explanation is it's sort of just cross signals, right? And yeah, they're saying she hadn't been to this local area since 1991, even though she said she'd been to other parts of Pennsylvania.
Yeah. I mean, but also if she had said, yeah, I was there in October, that doesn't mean she was there December 15th, 1994. I mean,
right.
Yeah.
Now, Jen, the one thing we do know from the memo, I mean, at least I think we can fairly interpret it, if the FBI is trying to say this is a murder for hire, it's because they think Patty couldn't have done this herself based upon her alibis. Jen, your review of the files, I mean, as far as we presented in the episode, Patty had been with Walter Blalock and he was known to be violent. Is there anything else in the files that gets the FBI to murder for hire? Or are they really just reaching from those two facts?
You know, I want to dive back in. I mean, I'm not sure if it's entirely relevant at this point, but like where that comes from exactly, like I am not clear. Yeah, that had been on my flag list of like things to talk to Robbie about at some point.
Yeah. And Robbie, what's your own? I mean, is there anything beyond she had been with Walter Blalock and he was known to be violent? I mean, is that the long and short of it?
That's it. That's the whole theory. Because they're grappling with like, what do we do with the fact that like they're all, we've talked to all these people and it seems like Patty probably was in North Carolina December 15th, 94. So what do we, you know, how do we understand that and how do we make a case out of this? They believe she's it. She is definitely it, but they have to figure out how she did it.
Right. From how she did it to the specific mechanics of how this killer did it. Big thing we discussed this episode is Trooper Kosovar. And obviously we have the claim that Patty had this gun and specifically that her gun would sometimes jam up. And we've laid out, we mentioned again this episode, Trooper Kosovar having this theory that the killer of Joe had the gun jammed up and that is why they bludgeoned her to death. And we have this question of, does this theory hold water? And so, Rabia, Can you remind listeners from the autopsy, the bullet wound in this case consisted of what?
The bullet wound was one single bullet into the face, like right under the eye. I think it was the right eye. And that would have been enough to kill a person, basically, is what I'm saying. So I don't understand the theory that, let's say, maybe the theory is that the killer tried to shoot Joe, the gun jammed, so they attack her with the gun, and then they try another shot, and then that shot kills her. I mean, what's interesting is that this trooper is trying to figure out, like, that person could have killed her with one shot or two shots or whatever, just killed her with a gun. Mm-hmm. Why did they do that? Why did they bludgeon her? And you know, that's what we talked about with Dr. Sasha Reed and others.
The overkill theory.
Yeah. It's a theory, Trooper Kochevar, but I don't know if it's necessarily fits the scenario, because after that one shot, there was no need. I think that shot was the final shot, right? Like, I think she was attacked. I think she was, you know, rendered completely helpless by all the blows. And then she was just shot in the face.
Right. And so, Jen, in terms of your own take on the evidence, as Rabia has noted, this gunshot to the face, it seemed to appear to a regular person to be capable of causing death. And of course, the evidence backs that up. And so, Jen, what is your own take on Trooper Kosovar's theory that I think this killer tried to shoot Joe, failed, and that was the reason for the bludgeoning versus the profile saying this is overkill above and beyond the shooting?
Yeah. When I was first researching this case and I heard that theory, I've never been able to wrap my mind around it, because it does seem exactly that, like, this shot would have been enough to, if not kill her instantly, it seems like at least like completely incapacitate her, right? I mean, it's directly in her head, in her skull. And so I don't understand why the fixation on needing a second shot, so you can't get the second shot, so then you beat the first. It seemed to me like that was backwards, that the beating, you know, would have happened potentially first, right? Even before hearing the
right. And think about the logistics of this. Like, you shoot somebody in the face, they are now on the ground. How are you going to bludgeon them on the top of the head? Are you picking them up and doing it? Are you kneeling down and doing it? Like, none, that doesn't make sense. It just, anyway.
Yeah.
But, you know, they're working backwards. They're getting information and they're trying to fit the facts of the case into whatever information they're getting, right? Like, that's all it is.
And like the whole thing about him having had a recent case too, like it reminded him
an older case.
Oh yeah, yeah, maybe not. But like it, that was that kind of interesting. Too. Yeah, because I feel like in some of the other cases we've worked on in the past in my research, I've seen that too, where I'm like, they've had cases in the past, and so it's like seeing a pattern in one place, and then maybe
you glom onto that, right? Yeah,
yeah. I'll say this. Look, I mean, like, I think we can see how the tunnel vision is happening here, and when we see, and we see this a lot in these kinds of cases, and you think, okay, it wasn't that they were like, it's not they were maliciously going after her or they were trying to frame her. They actually believed, the authorities actually believed it was her. They're just trying to figure out how she did it and how it was done. However, in next week's episode, we're going to talk about something which makes me wonder if it was not malicious, if they knew that they had the wrong person, because there's something that happens that is kind of inexplicable in any other way to understand, like how they handled some evidence.
And so, having gone through this question of jammed gun versus overkill, and then as Jen mentioned, this recent case and whether Kosovar anchored to that and tried to apply the logic here, Robbie, my last talking point before getting to the listener questions and the speakback messages is the profile, again, of the killer in this case. And I have here in the talking point the FBI agent recounting the 1995 profile of the killer and that being unreliable. And so what's the detail you have about this profile created of the killer?
Well, I do know why, but okay. I'll tell you why. Because so what happens in the 2002 interview this FBI agent does, he talks about what happens when Patty is arrested, okay? Except that we have a report of what actually happened when Patty was arrested. And we're going to get into that. And those two things don't match at all. And so his recollection, and I get that, he's a human being. His recollection many years later is colored by lots of different things and our realities change. But that in and of itself shows me that you know, I can't completely rely on what he's telling me because the details he gives of this arrest are in fact inaccurate. Of the arrest and of the when she's taken to get her a search warrant executed to collect her hair and DNA or blood, excuse me. So because he gets those details wrong, because I remember when I read it, I was like, oh, okay. So, I mean, you know, you look at these documents and you're like, all right, sometimes you're like, okay, I guess that's how it went down. And you're like, oh, is that gospel? And then I found the report of the actual incident. I'm like, okay, that's not how it happened at all. So that's how I know.
Got it. All right. And so from that, let's turn to the listener questions. And the first kind of ties into the big reveal we had this episode. This is Jenny Bradford. Just listening to the addendum, the last addendum, and I have a thought on why the junk science of hair comparison analysis isn't leading to as many exonerations as the junk science of bite mark analysis. My guess is that it's the difference between this person was here and left traces themselves behind. And on the other hand, this person attacked the victim. Mm-hmm. Bit them hard enough to leave marks. Obviously, both are bunk, but the first would only be part of a case, and the second, if true, would almost be proof by itself. And of course, that takes us to the hair found in Joe's hands. And I'm wondering, for both of you, I mean, my theory would be that the killer was attacking Joe, and Joe, you know, grabbed the hair of the attacker, and that's the reason the hand has the hair. Robbie, is that your own take? Do you think that was Joe pulling the hair off, or do you think maybe just a hair fell into her hands?
I don't know, but here's the thing. Because it was like kind of grasped in her right hand, I don't think it was some random hair that got picked up, you know, like from home or from, you know what I mean? Like that's, and you know, mm-hmm. and she's found under, not exactly buried, but a bunch of leaves. So I think whatever that hair ended up in her hand because of whatever the last moments of her life, something happened a lot, you know, so I don't know exactly, you know, maybe it was her grabbing at hair, but I would be surprised if more hair hadn't come out. Like, you know what I mean? If you're like fighting for your life type of thing, because again, we don't have defensive wounds, but whatever happened, I think that hair ended up because of however things went down and right before she was killed. And I promise you, we're gonna get to that. You think that hair would be the end all be all? You will be shocked.
Yeah, and Jen, what's your own take? As Ravia notes, we could say it comes from the attack. On the other hand, it's just one hair, which is a little bit weird as opposed to multiple hairs. What's your own thought, Jen, about how that hair ended up in Joe's hand?
Yeah, I mean, for me, like, regardless of how it ended up there, it's like, if it's found on her hand, in her hand, like, at the scene of, you know, where her body is found, I don't know, from a layperson's standpoint, it seems like that would be something really important to try to get to the bottom of. Like, it's, you know, it's at the scene on her. And maybe another thing related to hair that I was surprised about, I don't know if this is common or not, but just reading through some of the reports, like, any hair that was found that appeared to be from the victim, like, visually was, Robbie, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was just sort of like, it appears to be the victim's hair, like, don't worry about it sort of thing. And what was like,
ignore it.
Yeah. And part of me was like, well, what if the killer had similar hair to the victim? How do you know what I mean? Like that surprised me. I mean, just to dismiss that, I don't know. I don't know if that is common.
I mean, look, here's the thing. I 100% you're right. I mean, Joe had dark hair, dark, long, dark hair. And I think they were just focusing on all the hairs that didn't look dark. And I get that if you're kind of prioritizing what you want to test and focus on, like the hair that was found on the seat, mm-hmm. right? The car seat, you know, and you would think the hair in her hand would be kind of like really, really mm-hmm. important because it is not a dark long hair. It is a blonde hair, a gray blonde hair. But, you know, we'll get into how the forensic examiner looked at these hairs. And I mean, it's pretty wild. It's pretty wild.
Yeah. Right, our next question is from Brittany McCullough. She says, who polices the police? There are an incredible number of cases where poor police work delays / denies justice or leads to a wrongful conviction. I believe there's a conflict of interest when only the local government oversees their police force. There should be a consistent neutral party providing oversight at a higher level. There are too many people out there that don't believe wrongful convictions are real. Is there any history of the DOJ reviewing any local law enforcement agencies? What events would trigger a review? The big thing here is the consent decree where someone comes in from the outside to monitor. I worked in the Breonna Taylor case. They did that with Louisville. If you watch the TV show Elsbeth, that's the whole plot of this show, a Chicago attorney and doing a consent decree with the New York police. But I mean, Rabia,
Baltimore,
that's usually based upon police officers shooting civilians. I've never heard of a consent decree or something like that based upon a spate of wrongful convictions.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's happened in Baltimore too, right? Yeah, I mean, like in Baltimore, it happened. It happened after that gun trace task force scandal. It takes a lot, basically, before we can get to a consent decree. Nobody polices the police, Brittany, basically. I mean, like there's internal affairs. And I can't speak for obviously every jurisdiction in the country, but in Maryland, there's something called the police's, they have a Bill of Rights, which protect police officers. Like the public cannot even have access to a record, like a police officer's record. Like, you know, like if there's disciplinary issues or if they've attacked civilians or like that is under seal. And even let's say I'm an attorney representing somebody who was attacked by a police officer, even for me to get that, I have to like go to court, get it under seal. I still cannot make it publicly available. So there's, and you know, police unions are super powerful. So nobody polices the police. It's as simple as that. However, the civilian oversight, like, you know, like, let's say, look at Philadelphia, right? You know, Larry Krasner comes in, people do have power to elect a DA, elect a mayor, elect people, in civilian leadership who are, or, you know, outside of police leadership who are not going to play by the same old rules and are going to create their own set of rules. You know, but the police fight back there too, right? Like, so we have in LA or you have in Philly where the police are, we're just not arresting anybody then because we don't want to like work with this guy, this DA. It's tough.
We had a lot of comments about a very interesting portion of the episode. So I'm curious to, I mean, we're all sort of armchair quarterbacking here, but these are the phone calls that they have Andy make to Patty. And so on our Facebook page, Storm Britton Alono writes, after listening to the old lovebirds talking on the phone, my mind is reeling. It sounded a little rehearsed or too comfortable, left my mind spinning. Jay Patterson, OMG, I was trying to figure out why that conversation bothered me. That's exactly why. Kimberly Foley, are you referring to the recording? You saying the ex-boyfriend was double-crossing the police? Storm, no, Andy, he sounded super shady and like he was still her boyfriend. I mean, to me, it sounded weird overall. It's weird. But I wonder, you know, I'll start with you, Jen. Like, Jen, when you heard these recordings between Andy and Patty, what was your initial spit take from what you were hearing?
Yeah, I mean, just emotionally, like gut went, like just the, I think he says like, hello, stranger, or hi, stranger, you know? And I'm just
like ew.
I mean, you know, but that's not evidence. Like it was a long time ago. Maybe that's just, I don't know. Like there's a million ways that could be explained, but yeah, just on a gut level, I'm like, I do not like that.
I remember we were listening to this together at the court, at the courthouse in Pennsylvania. And Jen and I both were like, what is happening here? Like, this is really, and by the way, our editor, Hannah, shout out to Hannah, did a great job cleaning up the audio so you can hear it better. But when you hear it without that cleanup, like they're speaking to each other with such gentleness and softness. It almost feels like they're still in a romantic, like a very loving romantic relationship in a way. And it's weird, especially given the circumstances. It's weird.
It does make me wonder from like an audio standpoint. I don't know how it works with recording phone calls. Like, I wonder if that was the actual listening experience because there's a softness to Patty's voice and it feels kind of muffled. I'm like, does that actually, you know what I mean? When they were talking on the phone,
maybe
when did it sound that way? Or is it just because it's, you know, 90s tech being used to like record two ends of a phone call?
I mean, look, I think the volume might be reflected differently from the call to the recording, but I think the cadence and the tone.
That's a good point.
And yeah, but here's the other thing is, you know, we also have to remember the context. Andy's trying to set her up, right? Andy is, you know, the whole hello stranger. I think Andy's just trying to kind of get into their old groove type of thing and be like, I'm not your enemy. I don't know what's going on. I don't know why they're coming after you. He's got the police listening. Mm-hmm. He's got all kinds of agendas at play at the same time, but it is deeply uncomfortable. I will say this though. They were still friends. It's as simple as that. Like all those years later, they were. And there's no denying that they were, and it seemed like a very comfortable, and look, she went to him when Hewitt beat her up, right? Like there is this still level of trust between them that seems like it could have easily been a long-term friendship, you know, well into the rest of their lives if Joe had been comfortable with it.
And Robbie, I wonder, we sort of catalog various relationships that Patty had. And I think other than one small incident with Andy, there was no interpersonal violence, etc. Do we know, was Andy the only partner that Patty had that was not sort of regularly abusive to her?
There were other people she dated that I have not seen any reports from. Including, I think there's a police officer she dated, right? And there was like this guy that she worked with. And I, you know, unless it happened and we just don't know, right? But it seems that, and even with Blalock, I mean, I don't know if there's reports of, do you remember, Jen, if there were reports, Hewitt for sure, but with Blalock, I don't remember if there's reports of abuse with Blalock, or they were just kind of like, they both kind of like fought each other type of thing, right? But I don't think there was ever an instance in which she called the police on Blalock. I think they were both just kind of terrible to each other.
Yeah, I'd have to look into it. I don't recall off the top of my head, so I wouldn't want to misspeak. Yeah. But yeah. I do, I mean, it sounded, you know, tempestuous, like, to say the least. And then her, the person she was seeing at the time, right, the new boyfriend, I don't know, I don't recall, like, the Cowboys, I don't recall reading anything about him, but I haven't.
Yeah, we haven't gotten to him yet. We'll get to him next week's episode. But yeah, I haven't seen reports of any other partners doing this to her.
So then from this phone call that Andy records with Patty, we have Shannon French. If Andy told him the fight call, the call where Joe told Patty not to call again, happened just a couple of days before the murder, which he did, the investigators clung to the idea that she would want revenge. They got the phone records to find out that wasn't true and still kept that motive. Tunnel vision is definitely the case, in my opinion. Is that your opinion, Robbie? They anchored on this and then couldn't get off of that theory?
Well, here's the thing. We're going to talk specifically about how they treated the cell phone records and when they looked at them, mm-hmm. how they read them. And it is mind-blowing to me that when they looked at these records and saw that there was no such phone call, but how they interpreted that. So we're going to hold off on that. Just wait till Monday and you're going to hear us talk about that. Yeah.
Okay. All right. And so then from this phone call between Andy and Patty and the nature of their relationship, we have this other relationship Georgina Tripp mentions. Wait, so Andy was still very close with a former girlfriend during his marriage to Joe, and they got married after Joe died. Am I hearing this right? I've worked, as listeners know, the Caitlin Conley case. She was accused of murdering Mary Yoder, and Mary Yoder's husband apparently had started a relationship and then is now with Mary Yoder's sister. And so, I mean, that's right, Jen, right? That she, in this case, this ex-girlfriend eventually married Andy after all this happened, right?
Yeah, that is correct as far as we can tell. Yep, there is, on the record that they had dated or, you know, had an intimate relationship before Joanne, and then later they do get married.
And how much, we know, obviously, that she spoke to the authorities in this case. How much in the file do we have about the nature of her relationship with Andy at the time that Joe disappears?
I mean, I think I read two statements from her, and it's not super detailed.
I think there's two statements.
It's not like, I haven't seen any other statements that where they ask other people about the relationship. I mean, you know, at trial.
And they don't even ask her about the relationship.
No, I mean, it's like a couple sentences, I think.
Right. They're asking, they're just kind of trying to position who she is in their life. They're asking mostly about Joe. Like, you know, what does she know about Joe? And that's, she's the one who's like, I took her stuff to a psychic and this is what she says. And you know, and by the way, you know, that psychic told her, if there is a psychic, in fact, told her that, you know, Joe and the baby might be in Louisiana. When they found the bodies, that's where Andy was. Andy was in Louisiana. The police had to contact him mm-hmm. there. And when he was asked, he's like, because a psychic said that they're here. So I'm just here looking for them. I mean, I don't know how you do that. How you just randomly show up in a whole state.
Well, actually, that was two different. Sorry. It was two different psychics.
Oh, is that a different psychic? I'm getting my psychics crossed.
Exactly. There was a psychic that she, like, it's interesting because that part of her statement, like, then just sort of, you know, takes a tangent onto, like, what the psychic had told her, who was a psychic in the area. And then another psychic that Andy had, or his family or somebody had talked with, was the one, I think it was, that told him about Louisiana later.
Okay. Yeah, you're right. This is the psychic that said they took her out of state. They brought her back into the state. They're holding her in some apartment somewhere. Very specific. Yeah, that was a different psychic.
And so, you know, comparing, contrasting this ex-girlfriend who then later married Andy versus Patty, we touch upon some of this in the episode. Patty had an abortion. She had some people speaking poorly of her character. And then shades of our prior series, Amanda Lewis, she had a child who died from SIDS. Mm. And yet clearly from the file, there are questions the police had about whether this was an accidental death. I mean, Rabia, in terms of the treatment of these two women in Andy's life, the two exes, how much do you think things like the abortion, the SIDS, et cetera, played into the tunnel vision they got for Patty?
I think, you know, it's just one of those things. This is how tunnel vision works. When the police, the investigators decide it is this person, then they can make everything look like this is the reason it's this person. Like, they're justifying their decision. Like, they're working backwards. And that's even like something factual, like phone records, right? Or even her, the death of her first child, which it was like, there was never an investigation into how this baby died. There was never any question about it. And, you know, maybe SIDS wasn't that well understood then. I don't know. People who knew Patty was like, she was never the same again. Her relatives were like, she was never the same again. In fact, a lot of folks said that's when she started drinking heavy, hanging out with the wrong people, was like, you know, just, she kind of spiraled. She never got over it. And I think we hear in the phone call that we played that when the police officer started digging up on that, she's like, are you kidding? Because he's like, oh, I thought you'd be over it. And she's like, do you not have children? So, you know, even something like that, where there's just no evidence, you know, they're going to turn against her. And so the fact that she did not keep a pregnancy, all this stuff, in the patriarchal mind, in the misogynistic mind, it's, I can see them thinking, oh, she just hates children and she's not a good mom.
Yeah. And Jen, to the point that Rabia just brought up, as we noted in the episode, once the police started effectively weaponizing the death of Patty's child, she essentially was non-cooperative, and understandably so, obviously. Jen, how much do you think that played a role in the investigation, the fact that the way they were approaching her about the death of her child turned her off and made her put up a front?
Yeah, I mean, I can completely understand why she, I mean, it's, to be asked that sort of question in the way that she describes is, I mean, it's so offensive and disturbing. And in general, it sounds like they, I mean, and from reading, they were poking around and asking people. I mean, she says, like, it's embarrassing. Like, she, you know, they're reaching out to people down there. I mean, I'm talking about in the broader sense of the investigation, you know, like being accused of these horrible things. Yeah, I feel like, similar to what Rabia said, like, I don't know that she could have done what she did a right way, because there would have been a way to spin anything that she did, right? Like, does she cooperate? Does she not?
She had been cooperating.
Exactly.
She's like, I'm telling you.
Yeah, she had, like, vouched for Andy's character, you know? I mean, yeah.
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 Yeah. And what she's seeing finally is that it's not working. And you know, she did the right thing. Mm-hmm. Because even if she continued to cooperate and talk to them, it wouldn't have mattered. Mm-hmm. They had honed in on her. It was going to be her. For better or worse, she did the right thing. And, you know, lesson to listeners, don't cooperate from the beginning.
Yeah.
Never should have cooperated. Then, like, talk to my lawyer from day one.
Right. Because they documented some of those early conversations and with her mom and everything. Right. And then you could spin it in a different way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right. One last listener comment before turning to a couple speak pipe messages. We have Meredith Tavares. I'm intrigued by this story since I grew up and still live in Lehigh Valley, and my family's home is in the development where Andy was supposedly working the day of Joe's disappearance. I jokingly asked my mother if she remembers seeing his truck. If the back door to Andy's home is tampered with upon the police's initial call to the home, why wasn't it noted in the police report and treated as a crime scene? And if it wasn't tampered with, why weren't they more concerned that it happened between their initial call and the call Andy made to them a few hours later? Both things can't be true. Also, I wonder if the profiler would think it's normal for a woman to break into the back of a home with a screwdriver in broad daylight. And so, I mean, Robbie, as we go through the police reports, et cetera, I mean, what is your take on the whole back door being tampered with and the phone line cut, et cetera?
Well, let me start with this, the second question about whether the Dr. Sasha Reed would think it's normal for a woman. We didn't talk about what was happening at the home because it's so clearly staged. I'm sorry that there's no way to like create a profile around that. And I just never asked her. I mean, I can ask and say, like, what kind of person do you think, what kind of perp would do that? And Jen, you know, and I have talked about this many times where it's really confusing about what that back door situation looked like. I mean, Andy's father in a statement says, I came to the house, which again, we don't even know if he was ever actually there that night. And that whole wooden panel was on the floor. I saw it on the floor. You know, I don't know exactly what the condition was, but here's the thing. I do think Andy needed a pretext to call them to the house, right? Like he needed a reason to call the police to the house. And that first reason was that the back door looks like it was broken in, right? So the police are called three times. They call because back door, they call because Joe's car is found, and they call the middle of the night because they're like, oh my goodness, the phone wire has been cut. So if he had called the police the first time to come to the house, or they came to, well, he called to ask about his wife. Then he's like, they're not paying attention. So he needed them to come. I'm assuming something was going on with the back door. He showed him something, right? But Jen, what do you think?
Yeah, this has been driving me nuts. And I mean, like there isn't anything mentioned about the back door in the page that we see from that very first report. Now, whether there's like an
But
extra
police
page,
reports suck.
that's a
Police reports
that,
suck.
yeah.
Yeah.
So maybe it's written somewhere in another note, but I don't see it from that initial report, which is confusing, you know? And they were only there for what? It was like 14 minutes or something. It was very a short amount of time. Yeah, the whole timeline surrounding that first evening has never, I've never felt like it's clear to me.
I think we have time for one or two SpeakPipe messages. So, Robbie, if you want to queue up the first of those messages.
All right, we've put a few, in fact, we're putting on hold, but anyhow, okay, so let's listen to this first one by Shay.
Hi, Undisclosed team. This is my third attempt. Going to try to get this in within the time limit. Big question, where was the baby while the murder was happening? Question mark. Big question mark there. Here's my theory. I don't think the baby was ever out of the car. I think the baby was in the car during the murder. Maybe he forced her out of the car at gunpoint, did what he did to her. If the baby was sleeping at that time, would have been very easy to then go back, get the baby, and lay the baby softly and quietly on his mom's tummy. He might not even have woken up right at that moment, especially being as little as he was. If the baby was awake, maybe he circled the block a minute till the baby fell asleep. Wouldn't be that hard to put a baby to sleep. And then go and place the baby while sleeping on the mom's tummy, because then the baby might not wake up right away. That's just my theory. What do you guys think?
We have one more listener comment also about the baby. I'm going to go ahead and play this from Joni, and then we'll address these together.
Hi, guys. My name's Joni. Love your podcast. Just thinking about the baby, Rabia said it best, whoever did this is a monster. But I think maybe we haven't addressed that the baby's not only a wild card, but it's also a very easy way to control a mother. So, whether it's her spouse who did it or not her spouse, if you have a gun and a baby in play, I just think you leave the baby in the car when you walk into the woods and you don't worry about it crying. You say to mom, if you cooperate, I won't hurt the baby. I mean, I just feel like there's all these, we haven't also thought about the baby being a way to control the situation, in addition to it being a wild card, just for food for thought. Thanks. Bye.
Yeah, I mean, look, if I'm trying to place myself in the mind of a killer, I would be worried. I would think about having the baby in the car, walking Joe to where she was killed. Then after that, walking back to the vehicle, getting the baby, bringing it to the mother, and then walking back to the car. I mean, that seems to add a lot of time and possibility of people seeing me if I'm doing that. But I don't know, Rabia, how long do you think that would all take to go back and get Alex and bring him in and then go back to the car?
Yeah, it wasn't like a super easy walk in and out. But, when Sarah and I, Sarah Kayla and I went out there, it was like the trail was complete. Everything was covered in snow. So, and that wasn't the case, I think, on December 15th, 94. But at a minimum, it would have taken maybe 6-7 minutes to get to a car, whichever street it would have been on. And yeah, it would have certainly increased the risk. I'm intrigued by folks trying to figure out if the baby was in the car or not the car. And I think it does come down to two things. Number one, the baby being really clean, like clothes being clean, and the risk of the baby crying. But the reason that I don't think the baby was left in the car is because it's a couple of things. Number one, we've discussed this before. I don't know a lot of moms who would just leave their baby in the car, like in the middle of the winter, right? And walk into the woods and just leave and be okay with it. But number two, because Joe had the diaper bag with her. Baby's in the car. Why is she taking the diaper bag with her? And it was by her shoulder. So it almost seemed like it was on her shoulder when she fell. And then number three, the rattle. And the fact that the baby had one hand outside of its little snowsuit, the other one was tucked in into the mitt. I think that the baby was probably holding the rattle and dropped it at some point, because that rattle is not found where all the other items are found, like where the diaper bag is found. Mm-hmm. It's like between the path, the trail, and where the bodies are found. Listen, it's also possible that somebody who's with Joe is holding the baby and Joe's just following them into the woods because, right? Yeah. Like
another listener commented on that.
Yeah. So it could be that. I don't know. But at the end of the day, wherever that baby was, and the other question I think is people are asking, wrapped up in all this, is does this mean there are maybe two people, somebody holding the baby? Yeah, maybe. I don't know, but I feel like if there was somebody else there, Joe would have been like, "What the f is going on?" And just, you know what I mean? Like, I think we would have seen a struggle, an attempt to run, just something. I don't know. Jen, do you have anything to add there?
No, I because it's not like the car wouldn't have been in view of, from what I understand, I have not been to the actual scene, but
it wouldn't
like,
have, yeah.
I can't imagine. I mean, I guess I could imagine if somebody said, you know, under duress, she was forced to leave the baby. But then it seems like that's a real big risk for anybody driving by, you know, and your headlights catch and you see like a baby in a passenger seat, you know, alone, like that would have been an instant, like called the police. So that, right.
Yeah, red.
Yeah, but I mean, maybe some, you know, maybe the seat was, if you're familiar with the baby seat and like the attachment, you know, somebody, the killer or somebody else could have even taken him in with the seat, you know, and then wiped down the bottom or something afterwards. So he could have been set down, you know, like.
Or they come back to get the baby. The baby's got the rattle in his hand and they carry the baby in, the rattle drop. I mean, like, I'm not saying it's not possible. I'm saying I don't know, but I just think the fact that she had the diaper bag with her, and I can't imagine leaving the baby in a car in a rural area outside a stretch of woods where you can't even see the car and keep an eye. I just,
someone could happen to drive by.
It seems like a big risk. Yeah.
There's a lot of
I feel like the mom wouldn't do it and the killer wouldn't do it.
Exactly. Yeah.
All right, let's play this next message from Eric.
Hi, Undisclosed. My name's Eric. I've been an avid follower from the beginning and find this season fascinating again as well. A couple of thoughts. Has there been anything to show that in any time prior to, obviously, the murder, that Andrew may have found out that he is unable to have kids, that maybe he took a test or something and maybe then confronted Joe about that? Secondly, with the death of Alex as well, to me it seems like maybe there could have been a second person involved that kept Alex occupied, or maybe even used the bottle to feed and maybe the rattle to keep Alex entertained while something else was going on in the murder of Joe. Has there been any evidence of a second person? Anyways, continuing to listen and looking forward to the full season.
All right. Two questions. The first, again, goes back to the paternity issue here. There's no evidence, I have seen no evidence of Andy ever having taken a test or determining for sure that he is able or not able to have children. The thing is, when this was brought up by others, you know, like Mrs. Chambers, Patty's mom, the police somehow came back and said, no, we have determined that he can. I don't know how they determined that. Jen, do you have any idea?
They got a sample.
Oh, they took a semen sample from him?
They did. Now, whether or not, I mean, you know, like that's sort of, I don't know what, you know, what the science was at the time, but they didn't, but that was before, I think, that might have even been before.
But just because they took a sample, there's no, what I'm saying is, I know they took some, but I didn't see a report. I did not see like a fertility report connected to that sample.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember. I remember seeing like a lab document that like confirmed like, or no, maybe it was testimony that somebody said. It might have been testimony from the trial that was like, you know, he was able to father a child, but they never did any testing to like do paternity confirmation. But that's sort of outside of that question.
All I ever, I mean, and look, it's, I've been reading this file for 2 years now, but what I remember is that the conclusion that he was able to father a child came from like one of the officers or one of the investigators saying it. I don't remember seeing an actual forensic report related to it, but I can imagine if Andy's never been tested and he's gone 40 years and had multiple long-term relationships with live-in girlfriends where they're not using any manner of birth control, and he's never had a baby, he might be like, oh, I can have a baby. I mean, like he might question it, right? Like, and again, these are women who had children with other partners. So I can see him questioning it either way. There's been no DNA test. This question has come up too. There's been no DNA testing to determine paternity in this case at all. Okay, let's see. Who else do we have? Let's do Lisa.
Hey, Rabia, Colin, and Jen. My name's Lisa. I'm a longtime listener, first-time caller, and big-time procrastinator. I meant to call in after the Dr. Reed episode, but I guess it's good that I waited because I just finished the latest addendum and the issue of the baby suffocation was revisited. And I am certainly not at the level of expertise as Dr. Reed, but I've been a therapist for about 25 years. And when I'm looking at the psychology of the person who killed these two people, to me, it seems like someone who has a lot of psychopathic traits but doesn't fully meet the criteria for psychopathy could convince himself or herself that they had justification for killing the adult, the mom, but maybe doesn't feel like they could make peace with themselves if they were the type of person, quote unquote, who could kill a baby. And so they also didn't want to deal with the baby. So they just sort of left it up to the fates, as it were. And they went home and kind of said, well, it's not really me that killed the baby. And that is a way that they could compartmentalize and live with themselves because, again, they're not entirely a psychopath. But that's my thought. Thanks for all you do. Bye.
Yeah, look, I mean, it's not like this is the first time, if this is a family annihilator situation, that we have seen a family annihilation in which the person has literally no violent record beforehand. We see this all the time. In fact, I mean, Clint Watts, there's so many others cases like that where like it just seems like a one-time offense. They go from like 0 to 100 and you see no evidence of any other violent tendency or psychopathy or anything like that. I don't think a person has to be psychopathic to do this is what I'm trying to say, because we haven't seen that in other cases. Whether there are certain tendencies, maybe. I do think it's an interesting a point that, you know, this person could have been like, I didn't kill the baby. I left the baby there, right? Like, you know, and so they don't take it lessens the guilt in that sense. They don't want to take responsibility for actually killing a baby. And I think that says something about that person. But yeah, I don't know. Maybe. Okay. I don't know. But I don't think it's necessary, I guess, is what I'm trying to say.
All right. Yeah. Well, I think that covers everything for episode 7. Arabia, can you tell listeners what to expect in episode 8?
Yeah. Well, first of all, let me say we did get 3 messages from Amy. Amy, I'm saving all 3 of those for our final addendum. So I just want you to know it's there. Episode 8, we are going to go into how the police, now that they know it couldn't be a murder for hire, at least not with Walter Blalock, you know, how do they then start making their case against Patty? How do they get around all of this evidence that she was in fact in North Carolina, all the different alibis, how they treat each one, what they do with the phone records, because they have to they have to cross these hurdles before they can be like, it's time to charge her. It's time to arrest her, right? So that's what the next episode is going to be. And I'm excited about it because we're also, the episode is going to be a conversation with Patty's longtime advocate, Tammy Mall.
All right, great. Well, thanks so much, Jen. Thanks, Rabia. And thanks, listeners. We will see you back Monday for episode 8 of The State versus Patricia Rohr.
Thanks, Colin. Thanks, Jen.
Thanks, Rabia. Thanks, Colin.
If you want even more undisclosed content, remember you can become a patron by signing up at patreon.com/undisclosedpod. And if you've got feedback for us, you can find us at speakpipe.com/undisclosed, where you can leave us an actual voice note. Don't forget to subscribe to our YouTube channel at Undisclosed Pod. You can follow us on Instagram and Facebook at Undisclosed Pod. And we've got our own little private Facebook group called the Toward Justice Community. All you got to do is answer 3 quick questions and I will let you in. You can follow me, Rabia, on Instagram at Rabia2, the number 2. And you can follow Colin at Evidence Prof on X and Blue Sky. Follow the podcast on X at Undisclosed Pod. We want to thank our sponsors, and I want to thank our intrepid team, our sound editor, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and my amazing investigator, Jennifer Leahy. And a very special thank you to true crime author and advocate, Tammy Mall, who made this season possible. Thank you, Tammy, for all your work.